Well, anyway, nice to be talking to you guys. I want to just say, in my conversation with physicists over the years, I've become aware that the biggest difference that's emerging between the part of the biology that I'm going to talk about anyway and physics is the tremendous importance of informational transactions in biological systems, particularly the enormous amount and complexity of genetic information. And biology is really becoming an information science. And that's what I want to talk about, is information processing, particularly regulatory information. So the reason I have this picture up here is that one of the questions that we all grew up with in biology is, what's the real causal explanation for the differences between different kinds of animals? And if I had been asked that question, say 40 years ago, and I was a graduate student, I would have said, well, the difference is obviously in the genes, and that much would have been right. But I would have thought that the sea urchin and the fish probably have different genes, and that would have been pretty much entirely wrong. The fact is that all of the all complex animals have essentially the same molecular biology toolkit. They have the same, particularly the genes that are important. When you look at things with different body plans, it's obvious that the genes that are important are the ones that make the body plans, in other words, that control development. And the genes that control development are mainly regulatory genes and genes that encode signaling systems, which enable every cell to know what's going on outside of it, and then produce responses at the level of gene expression. And those genes are all the same in the sea urchin and the fish and in every other animal. So what's the difference? What's the causal explanation for the difference in these creatures? And that has been a profoundly interesting question for a century, and now we know the answer to it. And the answer is hardwiring of regulatory programs in the DNA. And by hardwiring, I mean literally the encoding of the regulatory apparatus and the regulatory information transactions in the nucleotide sequence. So that's as hardwired as you can get in biology. And so we're just beginning to understand that, how it works. And what I'm going to do is show you some evidence of exactly how one of these regulatory systems, and these are all system problems, works at an individual gene level in development. A system that we've beaten to death, I think, is probably the best known regulatory apparatus there is in animals at this point, I mean, at a single gene level. Then I want to talk about the kind of problem that is facing our field, which is unsolved and is yet not completely even parsed in any laboratory as yet, but which everyone knows lies ahead, which is analysis and understanding of gene networks or intergenic systems that control large-scale events in development that are responsible for changes in form and so forth. So that's the program. So I want to start with a couple of principles. The big problem, which turns out to be very expensive in biological information, in regulatory information, and you can count it up any way you want, but it's very expensive, is arranging spatial domains of gene expression. And that's, of course, the fundamental problem that the system controlling development has to face, is putting the right gene expression in the right place. The reason it's you'll see, I think. Ask me a little bit later, but The reason it's expensive is because of the number of inputs that are required per gene or per regulatory system to control spatial gene expression. And I'll show you a simple example. I mean, it's not that simple, but it's a typical example in a little while. There are a lot of inputs required, negative, positive, and signaling inputs. And that's really the point I want to make here, which is that if you put yourself in the position of a gene that has to know where and when to be expressed, you're putting yourself in the position of an entity that requires a lot of external information. It requires to use that information. And if this is a gene, the gene's down here, this is the part that encodes the protein, and in this talk we're not going to be concerned with those parts, only the upstream parts, which can of course also be downstream or in an intron or anywhere else, that control where and when the gene is expressed. This little diagram shows a number of relevant concepts, at least from my point of view. One is that there are modular I'll let you do that. Thank you. Yeah. There are a number of modular information processing devices that control gene expression. Often you find that one stretch of a couple of hundred base pairs of DNA will contain target sites for a number of transcription factors, and those transcription factors work together to, in a biochemical sense, promote gene expression. And they use a very promiscuous basal transcription apparatus that will respond to instructions from any of these regulatory modules. And there's very little intelligence, quote unquote, in the basal transcription apparatus. It obeys, they will usually obey any regulatory device as shown by experiment. But, okay, this is okay. Yeah, but the point I want to make is that every transcription factor which binds DNA in one of these elements is actually bringing to the gene some information about external circumstances, external to the gene. For example, this transcription factor might be presented to the gene only in a certain cell lineage, so it tells the gene where it is with respect to cell lineage. It might be presented only if the cells have to go into cycle, that's to say replicate. It might be presented to the gene only when a cell next door is talking to the cell in which that we're looking at. So you could consider the incidence of transcription factors in these regulatory apparatuses, these modular regulatory apparatuses, as bringing information to the gene, and then what happens is that through certain kinds of interactions that occur within these regulatory systems, that information is processed, and the result is essentially a single scalar output that says to the basal transcription apparatus, initiate RNA synthesis at some rate. So this is, a profound point, because if it weren't for the information processing capability of gene regulatory systems, there would be no such thing as development, there would be no such thing as animals, and there would be no such thing as animal evolution either. So this is really the basic qualitative characteristic of these regulatory devices, is their information processing devices. And as the diagram indicates, they receive multiple inputs, and there may be different ones that work in different domains of the animal on the same gene. And sometimes there are 10 of these things, or 15 of these things, or 4 of these things for a given gene that may mediate its expression in the head, the foot, and everywhere else.
How about using those 10 out of each module?
Yes.
But each module is typical size
of the four? Each module will receive another set of inputs. An average is 4 to 8. That's qualitative. Now, there may be multiple sites for individual transcription factors, but that's a quantitative issue that increases the probability of occupancy at given transcription factor concentration. So the 4 to 8 refers to, that's based on a scan of a large number of these things that we did a couple of years ago. And 4 to 8 refers to qualitatively different inputs. So I used the term hardwired quite deliberately, and if you look at, and you probably in this series have looked at these kinds of things already, but if you look at the intimate connections between transcription factor proteins, or the controlling proteins that control gene expression independently, in other words, each one of these interactions is like what's shown here. These are two different kinds of transcription factor interacting with DNA, one presented in a chemist's space-filling model and the other more diagrammatically. So this is one kind of transcription factor, for instance, it's like a scissors. It has two elements and they wrap around the major groove of the DNA going in opposite directions. But you can see the intimacy of the contact with the DNA structure, and here you can see specific chemical side chains interacting with the base pairs, the side chains, amino acid side chains, and the protein that interact with specific base pairs. So the point is that the DNA sequence causally determines the quality of the interaction. In other words, it determines which transcription factor the gene's going to listen to. So the cell is full of transcription factors, the nucleus. Which ones affect a given modular regulatory system depends on that DNA sequence in here, because there are 1,000 other factors there too. We all know, we've known forever, that somehow this is encoded in the DNA, because the sperm and egg of a dog produces a dog, and the sperm and egg of a sea urchin produces a sea urchin. We've always known the information is in the genome, but the kind of information that's in the genome that makes that difference is regulatory information, because we all have the same toolkit. So with that little introduction, I want to introduce you to a biological system for a few minutes so that we can look at what it takes to regulate a gene on a in a mechanistic way. So this is a diagram of a sea urchin embryo. And if there's one thing that molecular biologists have learned over the last 30 years, it's study something relatively simple and you'll have a better chance of learning something. So we study probably one of the simplest embryos that you can find, animal embryos. And the reason it's simple is because the product of embryogenesis 3 days after fertilization of the egg is not a sea urchin with all its spines and 2 feet. It's a very simple little larva that is free living. It can swim in the ocean and feed on algae. It has a stomach and a mouth and an anus and a single cell thick wall and about 12 different cell types. So it's a pretty simple structure. And the reason it's so simple is that it's a two-stage development. The adult body plan of a sea urchin forms over the next month or two while this thing's swimming around inside of it. So I'm not concerned with that. What we're interested in here is the transit from a ball of cells to a differentiated little creature that can actually feed and move around.
How complicated is the sea urchin evolutionary ladder? What's the genome size? How many cells does it have?
The adult?
More complex than nematode or less?
The adult?
The organism.
The adult organism.
Yeah.
Because, as I was just saying, this thing is less complex than any adult
genome
organism. Genome is, but it uses only about a quarter of its genes to make this. The genome size is about 1/4 of yours and mine. 1/4, 1/4, 25% in length of DNA.
It's like 800 megabits?
Exactly. And And it's pretty large. A lot of it is repetitive. About one quarter of it is repetitive sequence, which is less than the case in human, and has probably about 20, maybe 20 to 25,000 genes in it. It is, as I will get to at the end of this talk, if I get there, in the great branch of evolution to which we also belong. The animal kingdom is divided into three large, the bilaterally arranged animal kingdom into three large groups of animals, and the echinoderms, of which the sea urchin is a representative, and the chordates and one other group constitute one of those clades. So it's more closely related to us than, for example, either of us are to nematodes or to flies. But as I say, the process of development to make this larva is distinct from those by which any animal's adult body plan is made because of the indirect nature of the adult development in this animal. That's a detail. Okay, so the color coding shows what the cells turn into, and this is a pretty fast process. This thing has about 1,000 cells. About a little less than 2,000 cells, so it's 10 or 11 divisions after fertilization. Already by a 60-cell stage, the cells, although the microscopist just sees a ball of cells, the cells know what they're doing, and molecular probes have revealed that by this point, there's already a mosaic of differential patterns of gene expression set up, and this thing's already running probably 8,000 or 9,000 different genes, most of them in some regulated fashion. And the cells talk to one another, and partly because of where they are in the egg, because they inherit different things from the egg, which is not isotropic, and partly due to signaling from one cell to another, the genes are controlled differentially, beginning right away early in development. So the gene I want to talk about is a gene that I claim is a garden variety gene. That means that any gene we might have looked at would give similar results. We know that that's true to some extent at least. And it's a gene that encodes some protein that's secreted into the midgut of the larva once it starts to feed. And it's probably used in some digestive function. We don't really know what it does. The gene goes on long before there is a gut. It goes on really when the embryo looks like this in the cells that are colored blue. And the question that we like to pose is, what does it take in terms of genetic regulatory information transaction to get the gene to be expressed where it's expressed? So let's look a little more carefully where it's expressed. The blue stain represents the immediate product of the gene. So it's a stain that's specifically indicative of the RNA that gene produces, that RNA sequence. So it's recognized by a complementary RNA to that specific RNA sequence, and then there's some color generating procedure that indicates where the probe is bound to the gene product. So you can see, as I said, that the gene begins to be expressed before there is a gut. And if you look at this embryo from the bottom, so if you look at it from down here a little bit later, you'll see a circular pattern. And the reason for that is that the cells underneath that ring of 8 cells that will produce the gut, and these will produce a skeleton of the larva, they do not express the gene. They're specified differently. And nor do the cells overlying these cells, which form portions of the ectodermal wall, ultimately, of the larva, express the gene. And so you get this circular pattern, bounded on the top by future ectoderm cells, bounded on the inside by future skeletogenic cells. You can see the cells that will form the skeleton that are colored red in that diagram moving into the inside of the embryo here. These cells continue to express that gene. The gut now moves into the interior of the embryo, and the whole gut expresses the gene, and then it turns off in the foregut, and turns off in the hindgut. So it remains running, which is its terminal location of expression, just in the midgut, foregut, hindgut. Okay?
So when it's expressed when you use the pure cell,
yes.
Pardon? What's happening to the protein?
It makes a protein at a low rate at that time. I don't know if there's any change in the rate of translation per message, but there's a small amount of message. So the point of this kind of development, which your excellent question raises, is that the embryo wants to proceed to carry out gene regulation and assign states of gene expression to these cells as fast as it can, whether the proteins are useful now or later. So a large number of these regulatory spatial sets, are set up quite early before the morphogenesis has caught up with it, so to speak. And there are many genes that do this.
This protein does not have any DNA binding?
No. That's a downstream, that's the point of it. It's a far downstream protein. There's no feedback of any kind on the gene. It's secreted protein. It's probably, it has some domains that suggest that it's used for binding calcium and for possibly for facilitating the movement of algae around the stomach. It's just called endo-16. Endoderm 16. It's become a famous gene just because of the regulatory analysis, but not much is known about the protein. So the main point about it is it's regulated. This is just a typical kind of embryo. So now suppose you're the gene, or suppose you want to tell a computer what do you have to put into it to get this pattern of expression. It's not very complicated, but you do have to decide somehow tell the gene to go on in that blue lineage of cells. It's got to respect the boundary above that disk. It's got to respect the boundary inside with the skeletogenic cells. Later on, it's got to run in that gut tube when it invaginates. And then there's a later phase of expression I will get into, and then it just has to turn off in the foregut and hindgut. So it's got to somehow get a lot of inputs into its regulatory system to enable it to do that much. And there's also an amplitude modulation, because after the gut forms, the rate of expression goes up very sharply, as you'll see in a moment. So if we start to ask the question, what is the apparatus that actually does this? So how can we look at that? And as you've probably seen in other talks in this series, the way that the problem of gene regulation has been broken open is by gene transfer into systems like this. So it turns out the sea urchin egg is very convenient for injecting genes into. So if you can inject a gene into the egg and it will get taken up into the nucleus, and you can do it efficiently, which we can do, then you can change the structure of what you inject. And if you want to, you can ask the question of what every nucleotide of DNA sequence in the regulatory piece of DNA that you inject is doing. So you can get a total structure function analysis of the regulatory system by gene transfer. And that's the way that we learn about how those systems work. So what you... Yes, okay, so can you see this corner of the blackboard? Yeah? Thanks, yeah. So now let's put the screen up for just a minute, yeah. It's that black thing. Yeah, the black, no, the black button over. Yeah. Yeah. Right, that's enough. That's enough. It's the black one. Okay, so anyway, so if this is the gene, and here's the protein coding sequence. And here's the 3' trailer, and here's some regulatory system upstream of the gene. What we do is we throw away the protein coding part and replace it with some other protein coding sequence which makes a color. It glows green or it turns blue or it does something we can detect spatially, or it makes an enzyme we can measure, whatever we want. So we call this a reporter. And of course you couldn't do any of this if you couldn't clone pieces of DNA. So I presume we all know what that means. So if not, I'll be happy to tell you. So we're okay. All right. So essentially we can take any piece of DNA we want and grow as much of it as we want using a little bacterial parasite that grows as a circle in many copies of bacteria. So this is a piece of the genomic DNA originally. So we cut the DNA out, including what was the original gene before I threw this away, and put it into a bacterial vector which will replicate. So we can grow it, we can get it out of the cells, and we can do anything we want to it. We can make pieces of the sequence in a DNA synthesis machine and stick them in here. We can mutate the sequence. We can do whatever we want. So that way, when we put this, so then we get rid of the vector if we have to. Anyway, we put this thing into a sea urchin egg and look and see where it's expressed. And you can see where it's expressed. And then you can change the sequence, the regulatory sequence, and look and see what that does. Or you can measure the output quantitatively and look and see what the changes you've made do. Or you can take the system to pieces and take a little piece of it and just put that on the reporter and see what happens then. So you can find out what every base pair in this regulatory system is doing if you do it intelligently. You can't do it just by changing them one by one because the system has parallel inputs and interacts, as you'll see, in a complicated way. So you have to think a little bit when you're doing these things. But is that a sufficient explanation? Yeah. Yeah. It's incorporated into the genome. Yeah. Well, there. That's right. Exactly. Now, you know, we don't want to wait for a year to find out what happens when it grows up, and so these are experiments you do overnight. You inject the egg, and then you raise the embryo. As I said, that whole process of embryogenesis only takes 3 days. So the next day or the day after you look and see where the thing's expressed. It is stably incorporated into the chromosomes. And the reason for that is that when it goes in the egg, the egg cytoplasm thinks it's a piece of its own chromosome. And as you know, there's rapid division in embryonic development, rapid cell division. So every time the cell divides, the nuclear membrane breaks and the chromatin is spilled into the cytoplasm, and there's an elaborate system for clothing that chromatin, which is the DNA nuclear protein, with other proteins and assembling it back in the nucleus. And so we just ride along on that system and we stick DNA in the cytoplasm here. Very convenient.
That means that in your altered genome has many copies of it?
Yes.
How many?
Probably, they concatenate together and we put spacers in them. And probably about 10 copies are being transcribed in this case. There probably are more in there in some cases. It's, the signals are amplified to some extent. It depends, of course, on if the rate of expression is limited by a transcription factor prevalence, they're not amplified, and that's usually the case. Yes, that's true. Well, in this particular case, it's a pretty compact system. So 2,500 base pairs does the job, as you'll see. So here's about 2 picoliters of DNA solution entering this egg. It's 70 microns in diameter. And this is a membrane that's raised off the egg when you add sperm to prevent further insemination of the egg. It's a natural. And then it begins to divide. So you can go down these plates, and numbers are important, and inject 3 to 8 or 9,000 eggs in a few hours in the morning. So that means that you can get a lot of data out of this system. That's important. It's very important because, as you'll see, the system has lots of moving parts. So the kind of thing you see is if you put the right stuff in a regulatory sense into the egg, the reporter, this is now, you're looking at a readout from one of these pieces of DNA we injected, the reporter is expressed in the right place. Here you see a great big clone of cells that have incorporated the DNA in the gut of this embryo, expressing it, which is where it ought to be expressed. The DNA goes in every cell, but in any individual embryo, it goes into one of the first 4 or 8 cells usually. But that's entirely random with respect to. Yes. Well, this thing doesn't really have any organs, but whatever you call them, yeah. Yes.
When it gets activated.
Yes, but only so. For example, in this particular case, some of the DNA is probably in these cells too, because I know that because I know the lineage of the embryo. But it doesn't turn blue just where the DNA is, only where the transcription factors that activate the genome. That's the point. So it's a reporter. That's the point. So it's a reporter for the presence of the trans apparatus as opposed to cis apparatus that runs that gene. Okay? We're not getting rid of anything endogenous, so we never affect the health of the animal. These are all ride-alongs. They make harmless products that we can see. So we're not interfering with the animal. We don't have to worry about second-order downstream effects of doing something. Now, I'll show you later, we can knock genes out and see what happens, but the interpretation of those things obviously depends on how far downstream the gene you look at. And you can be looking at an enormously refracted set of echoes from your initial lesion if you do that. We're not affecting the natural genetic apparatus. We're just letting it ride along and detect for us where the regulatory inputs are. Yeah, you could, but the factors are present in such excess that, not great excess, but so the number of copies doesn't affect this. Now, this is another issue. Because of the equilibrium constants that describe the interaction of transcription factors in DNA, there are usually something like anywhere between 10,000 to 100,000 times more. Of course, there's usually only about 1,000 molecules of these factors in the nucleus, but their preference for the specific target site is about 10 to 100,000 times their preference for nonspecific DNA. But most of the factor will at all times be, well, there's only two target sites in a diploid genome for a single copy gene. So maybe there's 50 sites for if it affects 25 different genes. But there's 1,000 copies, and most of those copies will be bound nonspecifically with very short dwell times elsewhere in the DNA. And basically the factors diffuse one-dimensionally along the DNA until they find the target site. And then when they find their target site, they're in residence. A typical amount of time is with a half, they form a complex that decays with a half-life, maybe 40 minutes or 2 hours or something like that, as opposed to milliseconds for nonspecific association. So maybe that gives you a little better feeling for the dynamics of the system.
You say that this cortex is incorporated within the whole chromosome, presumably not where the original.
It doesn't make any difference. That's correct. Never where the original gene was. And experiments of this kind done in every animal shows that, in general, it doesn't make any difference where the DNA goes, with the exception of some dead spots in the genome. We all have them in all of our genomes, where the DNA is wrapped up in other proteins to such an extent that transcription factors can't see the target sites. And there are such places, but they're a minor fraction of the DNA in most genomes. In our genomes, for instance, is probably about 10% of the DNA is like that. So if you put a gene in one of those places, it doesn't work very well, usually.
So in principle, in an organism, this could, in one experiment, if you could go into one chromosome and another into
that's
another
right,
chromosome,
exactly.
It doesn't matter.
Doesn't matter. And it doesn't matter because the net, and this is one of the things.
It doesn't care which chromosome.
That's right, because it's a diffusion-limited system, as I was just describing to him. So the trans factors diffuse all over the DNA. And there's very little, fortunately, it would be a disaster if it weren't this way to analyze. Fortunately, the location in the infinitely long DNA is not very important. If it's important, there are so many permissive locations everywhere that it might as well not matter. So it's true that if you look and see where genes that are being actively expressed or located, they tend to be in areas close to the inside of the nuclear membrane. But those areas must include most of the chromatin anyway, so it doesn't really matter. And the fact is that, as everyone has learned from Drosophila, from mammalian cells, from sea urchins, from C. elegans, where something like the same thing is true, all these gene transfer systems put the DNA anywhere. Only in mouse can you put it actually in place of the gene that was there if you go to the trouble of doing so. And at the same time, knock out the endogenous gene, which can be done. It's a very expensive operation, so it's not done that much. Except for disease genes, of course. But the lesson that the general lesson is, it doesn't matter where it is, and the reason is that the necessary and sufficient regulatory information is encoded in a little piece of regulatory DNA. If you put it in there, it'll work, because as long as you associate it with the gene or with the reporter. Now, let's look at what interactions actually exist in this particular case in the piece of DNA that is necessary and sufficient to give accurate spatial and temporal expression of this gene. Now, I'm not going to show you all the evidence that it does give accurate spatial and temporal expression, but it does. Can I explain something?
There was a question about whether there could be point interaction with the notion that we have already learned that sometimes there is a folding so that the remote region of the upstream interact with each other. The question was, does this always only happen just within the upstream region of a given gene and not between two different genes?
Yeah, that's
in that case, where the case
could be a disaster. There are two things to say about that. One is that many genes have, first place, genes are pretty far apart. Probably the average distance between genes in a sea urchin is about 30 kilobases, 30,000 base pairs. And so there's a lot of space that insulates one gene from another. In addition, there are specific insulators. And often when genes are close together, there are particular stretches of DNA sequence that attract proteins that really act like insulators. So if you put a regulatory system on this side, it won't affect the gene on that side. So those things exist. And in addition, it is my belief on evidence that's not really causal that the folding patterns are actually specified by DNA folding proteins that bind at specific target sites within these regulatory systems. And I can show you such, and we've studied them, and so we know they're there, and the target sites for the one we know the most about are present in every gene we've ever looked at, including this one. So I think that the folding within these extended regulatory systems is part of the genetic program. Is that clear? Yeah. So what you see here is a map of about 2,500 base pairs upstream of the endo16 gene. And this is a piece of DNA that suffices to give the right expression that you saw. So it just faithfully copies what the natural gene does when we put it in the egg. And so one of my associates, Kathy Yu, and I devised a quick method for mapping high specificity DNA protein interactions. So here's a philosophical point. You would hope that a DNA protein interaction would be tight enough so that would be specified by a sufficient length of sequence that it would uniquely determine the binding of the transcription factor, so it wouldn't, the transcription factor wouldn't find 5 million places that it liked equally well. And so that means the longer the site of interaction, the tighter the chemical bond, that's to say the slower the dissociation rate constant will be for the complex. And so you'd hope that everything would fit together and that if you find a specific interaction, you'll find a function because it's meaningful, and you do. And just 10 years ago, we didn't know that would be true, but it turns out that every time you find an interaction within one of these systems, these regulatory systems that you can show works, where the preference of the transcription factor for a target site is more than, say, four orders of magnitude or greater than its affinity for any DNA sequence, you will find a function if you interrupt that interaction in life. So that's a very important little piece of reassurance that we're not barking up the wrong tree here. Yeah, so if you, as I was just saying, transcription factors all have, because they're positively charged proteins, because they're basic proteins, transcription factors all have a non-specific affinity for DNA, but it's low. So what I said is, if you take a piece of DNA that you know when you inject it into an egg, for example, with a reporter, it gives you the right pattern of expression, so you're dealing with the real stuff, and you look in that DNA, that every interaction you can detect such that the preference of the protein for that target site compared to its preference for any piece of any double-stranded DNA polynucleotide sequence is four orders of magnitude or more. If you find that out, then you will have a meaningful interaction, as proved by the point that if you interrupt the interaction, you'll get some effect on gene expression. It'll do something bad. Every interaction is meaningful if it's a tight interaction.
Compare that to the best of the rest of the genome, or
compare it to. So these proteins, as you saw, that it's not a sliding scale really, as you saw from. And these diagrams, there are specific places it likes. They have to have the right sequence, and those target sites are somewhere 6, 8, 10 base pairs long. So the length of sequence both suffices to define the site fairly well. Often these factors interact. For instance, if you have a sequence, a site that's about 12 long, you're not going to have it by accident occurring in these genomes. Often the sites are shorter, but the factors bind together with other factors, add the specificity together. You have from a combinatorial point of view a uniquely defined site, but you also have a chemical interaction which is so strong that the protein will stay there for a while. And what I'm saying is, in a way of measuring that interaction, the proper way of measuring it is the ratio of its affinity for that target site to any place, any DNA that doesn't have these particular base pairs. But because the transcription factors are positively charged and the DNA has negatively charged phosphates on its backbone, the transcription factor has a weak affinity for DNA irrespective of sequence. So it's that, but some proteins are more basic than others, and so the absolute number of affinity isn't what you want. It's the ratio of specific to non-specific interaction. What I said was, if you find a interaction where the ratio is greater than four orders of magnitude, you will find a functional interaction. Yeah. Well, you don't really need to have it greater than that, because what you need to have is a target site that's, or assemblage of target sites that uniquely specifies that position in the genome.
And the converse is also true if you find the protein and the sequence which you know are bound. This is the regulatory protein that binds that sequence. And the average, the affinity is 10 to the 4 times larger than.
Yeah.
And 10 to the 4 is okay.
Well, that's a base. That's a baseline that we use, but some of them are much higher than that. I mean, it's a range, of course. Some of them have. Many of the factors that you see here, well, these are proteins, and these are the target sites. There are 13 different proteins in that system, and
Can only say that for a complex of proteins.
No,
a single protein is only recognizing 6 to 8 sites. You can find them.
You can find, if you have a single protein, it will find many target sites. But when it finds one of the target sites that means something, or any one of the target sites, which 8 will of course occur every 100,000, every 60,000 base pairs or so. But wherever it finds the right target site, then you will find that it binds tightly to that site. 8 base pairs, because of Arrhenius' law, 8 base pairs can make a very tight interaction. So, no, it depends on the species of protein. Some see 6, some see 8. So, like for example, a common kind of transcription factor is the zinc finger factors. They may have 2 zinc fingers, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. Each one sees 3 base pairs specifically. So. it depends on which one you're looking at, what the target site would be. The one that I show that has a scissors, those things usually see palindromic sites that have reverse orientation, as you could see from the structure. And there are five or six going in each direction, so the total is 10 or 12 of a site that's organized exactly like this. And it binds very tightly. But different factors are different. Some of the most famous ones, like the Hox genes, bind weakly, but they always bind with cofactors. And together, it's not weak anymore. But I could spend a whole time discussing DNA protein interaction, physical chemistry, which is a fascinating subject that I enjoy very much, but I can't talk about the informational aspect of these systems, which is what I'll talk about whatever you want, but.
We already heard quite a few lectures on what you just said you would not like to talk about.
I'll be happy to do so, but I see you're not exactly a naive crew on this subject. All right, so let's look at the complexity of this system. There are 13 different interactions here. And the ones that are shown above the line, which represents the DNA, the regulatory DNA, occur only in specific regions of this system. And the ones that, as the color coding indicates, are below, occur in several regions each. Somebody asked me about DNA folding. I think you did. This yellow protein has the property that once it binds to DNA, the other end of it will bind to itself. So consequently, it's a DNA looping protein. And the efficiency at which it forms loops depends on the number of molecules it's bound. Right? So it can multimerize, and so if it's attached to DNA, it'll cause a loop, and we showed that, and you can see the loops in the electron microscope if you want to. I didn't bring a picture, but we studied that some years back. Anyway, forget that. Let's talk about the rest of the system. I think so. I think it's regulated by the binding target sites.
So different things that are differentiated for drastic things.
I think that probably it has some architectural function so that distant pieces, and this is pretty long in real terms, this part of the system which actually interacts with this part is pretty far away in terms of the dimensions of a protein. And so in order for the interaction to occur, the DNA has to loop. What I'm saying is that looping is probably facilitated by the binding in the system in a sequence-specific binding in the system of a protein that once it binds, the other end of it will bind another one that's bound somewhere else, thereby producing a loop.
But that binding loop, can you define what you mean by unique factors and binding factors?
Just that these guys bind only in that particular, this one binds only in this region, this one only in this region, and this one, on the other hand, binds in several regions, that's all.
And the yellow guys can bind everywhere.
Yeah. Well, those are specific target sites for them, though.
Yeah, on these red sites.
Yes.
So this looping could be a more generic thing.
That's correct. I think it facilitates, so if you take those looping sites out, you get a weaker response, but it doesn't change anything else. It's a facilitator. That's what I think. Okay, so how does this guy work? How does this system work? What do all these things do? And we haven't cloned all these proteins. Some of them we know what they are, some we don't. How does this thing work? So here's an overview of how it works. And this is just an overview, and it would take me a whole course to take you through all the experiments that led to this overview. And I want to talk about something else, which is the details of the informational transactions that go on in the A and B regions close to the start, which is what I'm going to get to in a minute. But I want to give you an overview of how the whole system works. So what you see here is the same thing as what you see here. Okay, so that's the distal end. That's where the RNA starts to be made. Possibly the previous diagram was made 5 years ago, it's possible.
Is denomination?
A, B, C, D, E, F, G. Is it different?
No, but the protein is underneath the same letters, but in a lot of
you mean these boxes? Or, huh?
There are regional, regions A to G, and there are proteins A to J, which are not in.
These guys.
Yes.
I'm going to talk to you about those.
No, but they have letters too, and they have nothing to do with
them. They're not the same thing.
No. Those are.
I'll find out.
I'm sorry. I confuse you. They're not the same thing. This is just a designation of pieces of the DNA. That's correct. These were provisional names until we cloned the proteins. That's an old diagram. I just want to show you for its complexity. What is the number of different kinds of proteins binding there? Forget the letters. Just look at the colors. You need to remember these letters, though. So I don't care about these letters. We know what it is. It's a homeodomain protein called. It's an orthodontical homologue, and the word J will never be used again. This was just, we knew there was a protein there. We didn't know what it was at first. Yeah, it's very clumsy nomenclature, but the point is that you'll notice these sites are clustered, and it turns out that the clusters have a meaning. And in our initial dissection of this system, we mostly respected the clusters, and where we didn't, we made a mistake, and where we did, we found that we had a modular unit of function. Okay, so here you can forget that there are no letters on the proteins. These are just the regions of the DNA. So let me just tell you in general how it works. Now, the problem, as I mentioned a while ago, is spatial control, spatial expression control. So early in development, this is an early late spatial control system. Early in development, the egg forms, and to turn this gene on, the system relies on a regulator, which is everywhere in the egg. But the gene doesn't go on everywhere in the egg. It goes on that ring of cells, as you saw. So I asked the question earlier, how does it do that? Here's how it does that. That ubiquitous regulator binds in region A, and in order to keep the gene on in just the right place, there are specific repressors that bind throughout here, and in this region there are repressors that bind in the cells that make the skeleton, which were red in my diagram, which account for the failure of the gene to run in the interior of that circle that you saw, and here are repressors that bind in the ectoderm that account for the absence of expression above that ring. So it's a mixed positive-negative spatial control system that makes use of a ubiquitously present early activator, which a lot of other genes also use. So the gene gets going by using this activator that binds here, and it controls its spatial expression out here. This is a booster, this region. Attach it to anything, it'll step its activity up about two or three fold, and that's all it does. So after development has proceeded a bit and the gut forms, then the rate of expression goes up, and the system now becomes completely independent of this ubiquitously present activator. And now it runs on a dedicated activator that's just present in the gut and that binds in the B region. And so at that point, you can throw this whole stuff away and the gene runs perfectly well. So it's an interesting point that there's about 2,000 base pairs of regulatory apparatus that's used only for about a day in the whole life of this animal. Just to control expression when the thing is getting going with an early embryonic activator, it's ubiquitously present. It works, but the control is shifted from a ubiquitous activator with a repression system to a dedicated activator, which essentially what happens is that the control shifted upstairs one level to the spatial control that determines where that activator is formed. Yeah.
That same code, E and F and so forth, is that present in other genes that you don't want to turn on?
Some others, yes. That we know what some of those proteins are. Some of these proteins, they're interesting because they're signal mediated. So those proteins are activated as repressors when they receive a signal, probably from the cells where this gene is running, that says, don't let this gene run next door to me. So. To a large extent, they work fine. Now, you can't screw around with the order in forever inside the modules. But you can make any combination of these regions that you want, it'll work fine in any order, except Module A is the central processing unit of this whole system. And that's interesting in itself. And without Module A, the repression doesn't work, even though the proteins bind. Without Module A, Module B doesn't work either. And so what I'm going to do now is descend beyond this purely descriptive argument to a more mechanistic look at how this system works. Do we have some problem?
No, no, we're just talking about the speaker's going to leave right at lunch, so we'll find the way.
I was only told to plan to be here from 10 to 12. That's what Terry told me, so. Yeah, you told me, yeah.
You can stay longer. We normally take a break, but then.
Oh, you want to take a break? We'll take a break. Right now? Can I go a little further and then you take a break? Is that okay? That'd be good. So, okay, because we're just getting into the intestines of this system right now. So, okay, so now we're going to go a little bit beyond a description of what I just told you to start trying to look at this from a little more abstract point of view. So this is partly what I just told you about the region A and B, which begins running on a ubiquitous factor, which is called OTX. We've cloned it. We know what it is. This is the repression upstream. And then later on, something else happens, which is the gene no longer wants to listen to this ubiquitous input because it doesn't want to have to pay attention to repression because the cells are moving around and it gets more complicated. And so it doesn't want to use the ubiquitous activator, which, however, is still present in the embryo. So there's an internal switch that turns off the input from this. So it doesn't listen to it, even though the protein's still there. And now there's another factor, which is abbreviated here, UI. It's also just been cloned. And that binds here, but there's now about a 4 or 5-fold synergistic amplification of the output of this factor alone that's due to an interaction of proteins that bind in A and B regions both. So there's a synergistic amplification. So now how does all that work? That's a sort of an outside diagram. And the result is, first we get expression in that ring of blue cells, and then we get an enhanced step-up of expression in the gut itself. So here's what the target sites, the cores of the target sites look like in real DNA nucleotide terms, what the spacing of those sites is. So all of the sites that were indicated on this diagram in the B and A region are shown here. So it's just A, C, G's, and T's, but just so you can see, it has a DNA sequence reality. So the analysis proceeds by asking a question, and these are all high specificity sites. The analysis proceeds by asking a question, what's the functional meaning of every one of those sites? And there are two ways of doing that, as I mentioned. You can destroy the sites individually or together, or you can also generate them by making DNA in a DNA synthesis machine and attach it to either the basal transcription apparatus or some other piece of this thing. You can do anything you want. You can change their order, their spacing, do anything you want. Okay, so now I'm going to show you some real data because you like to see hard nuts data for a few minutes, but this is what we're going to come out with, which is a model that looks like a little analog device. It's a logic device, basically. And these are the target sites that you just saw the biochemical manifestation of. And the consequence of occupancy of these sites is execution of some logic function, essentially. And so what this model is the result of hundreds of experiments, more than 100 experiments anyway, different kinds of perturbations of the system that enable us to predict exactly what the regulatory output's going to be, no matter what you do to this site thing, whether you mutate this site or that site or step up the inputs of this or that. And this is partly a Boolean and partly a continuous processing system. So the lines that are solid are lines that represent inputs from transcription factors, the activity of which or the concentration of which varies during life with time, vary over time. And the dashed lines are proteins that seem to be present all the time, and or they're not present, of course, if you mutate the site. And you can regard them as if they're there, yes, and if they're not there, no. But this is basically a system for processing time-varying inputs at this site and this site, and to some extent this site as well. So now this is what we're going to come out with, and what I want to show you is the kinds of measurements that allow us to draw these conclusions. So, and we can take a break now, and I'll return to this.
Really okay.
Okay. All right. So, I want to just give you an idea, without going through too many details, of how we get the measurements that lead to this kind of model. Huh? So, as I mentioned, our reporters that you put in can be measured quantitatively as well as by looking at where the blue stain is or the green stain. So what we've done is use kinetics. I'll just give you an example of two experiments. So now, if you take just module A alone, okay, and attach it to the reporter and measure the amount of reporter activity in batches of embryos as a function of time after fertilization. Okay, here's what happens with just module A alone. Yes, it's averaged over every cell, but only those cells in the ring are expressing, and then only the gut. We know how many cells there are. We could express this per cell. That's right. No. I said the regulator of A is present everywhere, but that's exactly correct. If I just take A, we get ectopic expression. Okay. That's true.
And you're adding up all those.
That's right. So you get this time course. If you take just B, same thing happens. You get this time course. And both A and B are rather low in amplitude. If you put A and B together, this is not about spatial expression right now, this is about quantitative expression. Put A and B together physically, you get the red curve. That's pretty different. So if you add A and B, you don't get the red curve, right? But if you put them together physically, you get the red curve. So that's telling you, if you want to consider this as a logically behaving system, it's telling you that there must be some interactions that must be specific in modules A and B that have the function of letting the basal transcription apparatus know that both are present and of amplifying the output. Are we together? Yeah. So, there are such interactions, and so in fact there turn out to be three specific target sites that are required for linking A and B functionally and amplifying the output. Now if you eyeball the red curve, you'll see what it is actually the black curve just multiplied by a scalar factor. A has nothing to do with it. So when you put these guys together, what happens through most of this time course is that it ignores the kinetic input from A and just amplifies, it kicks up the output of B, if you want to look at it that way. So that's kind of interesting. And so the dashed line is in fact a calculated output of just taking B and multiplying it by 4.2 or something. This has been done a lot of times, and you always get that same result.
39 minutes?
Hours. So development's over by now. I mean, it's a little... Okay, so this is a kinetic experiment in which we're measuring the output of the reporter at intervals of some hours. And there are three different constructs shown here. One is A alone in blue. One is B alone. Those are those regions, A and B. And the red one is what happens when A and B are physically joined to one another. And the point is that if you add these curves, you don't get the red curve. So the consequence is that there are two logical consequences that this experiment implies if you really want to regard this as a little machine. One is because the red curve is just an amplification of the form of the kinetics of the black curve, there must be a device that shuts off the input from module A throughout most of this time course. And there must be also an amplification of the output from module B that occurs by something that binds in module A, because you see it when you attach module A to module B together. Okay? So now we can test those predictions. So if the latter prediction is true, then if we were to find the place where the protein needed for this amplification binds and we mutated that target site, what would you predict? What you would logically predict is that you would dissociate A from B and just get A back, even though B was still sitting there attached to it. So here's that experiment. This is one of the target sites mutated. There are actually three proteins that bind that are involved with this, two in A and one in B. Both mutations, which are shown here, compared to what it has when... Now, these are three or four base pairs change in this thing of 700 base pairs long of B and A joined together. And you get these very different outputs. This is one target site, it's another target site. And what these curves are is exactly what A would give you. It's just blind to the presence of B in there once you unlink them by mutating these sites, and the amplification is gone, and the signature that you see of B-driven expression is this late rise, which is responsible for kicking the expression up once the gut develops. Okay, so that's an example of the kind of data, and I can go on from here. So by similar experience, we proved there's another site that's responsible for turning off the input from A. Yeah?
So what's the red curve on the right side?
Red curve is exactly the same as this curve in a separate experiment. It's the output of B and A stuck together.
Without any mutations.
Without any mutations. Okay? So it's a very well-behaved system that allows us to make quantitative predictions and indicate. So now, why am I going through all this? Because what I want to do is take this down to the level of what the target sites do functionally and describe this thing as an information processing device, because that's what it is. Yeah. There's no B curve over here. It's a little different than this, and it's a separate experiment, and the embryos were much more active, but that's arbitrary. It depends on how long you let the enzyme assay incubate as to how much activity you get. It's the kinetics is what counts, yeah. The absolute values are not very important. Yes, yes, essentially. We normalize to, usually we normalize to the peak of the BA curve and then do just what you said. Exactly so. And in as you can see, because this is simply the product of the black curve by a constant factor. So the answer is, of course, yes. The dashed line is taking the black curve and multiplying it by 4.2. It's exactly the case. So it's pretty nicely behaved. So here's mutation of another one of these linker sequences compared to module A alone in the same experiments, exactly the same thing. If there is a, this is the last experiment I'll show you, if there is a repressor inside this system that turns off module A input into the system, just thinking of it in terms of input, then if we mutate that site, we should get more activity out. So that's this. Now, why would you get more activity? Because now you get input from A plus input from B amplified. So you get more activity if you kill that site. But it should only work early, because that's when module A is functional. It shouldn't affect late activity, because module A activity goes away then. And so it does exactly what you expect. And if that's true, if you take that site and make a little piece of synthetic DNA with that site on and stick it on module A, you should make it activity drop down. And you do. That's what that experiment is. So the nice thing about this system is that once you figure out what's there, then you can make all the predictions in the world and test them. And so that's how we arrived at this model. So I'll tell you what all these things do. And I'll also like to just mention, why make a model? I mean, it looks kind of jazzy, but there's a lot more reason. The first reason is we never could have figured this system out if we hadn't tried to make a model. And this is, of course, this is iteration 47 of the model, because when you start drawing lines, then you have to say, should it go here, should it go there? So it was a necessary step in solving this nonlinear looking thing. Secondly, it provides us with quantitative predictions. We can ask what would be the output in terms of pieces of the system for every mutation of every target site and test it. As I just showed you these two examples, we've done most of those tests. And thirdly, it's philosophically interesting because of what kind of model it is, a logic model. And so, for instance, this linkage system I just showed you, which involves these three proteins that link module A and B, all three of them, if you mutate them, give you back just the output from module A alone, which depends basically on this driver this OTX driver that's the ubiquitously present factor whose activity goes up and then comes down. So those guys do what you could call AND logic, as well as do an amplification of the output of module B. And this is just a way of formally showing the repression of OTX input into the system, which is mediated by that site, which is the one we mutated in order to get the result I showed you on that last graph. So what happens is that module A initially processes all of the negative inputs from upstream, and they're shown here. And if this interaction isn't here, they don't work. Module A starts the activity off, and there's no activity early on because this transcription factor isn't there early on. Once this transcription factor appears, it uses these two ancillary proteins which boost its output, and you can consider its output is transferred to here, and it's then amplified due to these three linker proteins. And late in development, when that activity is high, OTX activity is turned off, and so that's the output. And if you mutate that thing, you get the sum of this and this and so forth. So what we have is you can see what the biochemistry does in terms of adding things or subtracting things. It's like a little analog computational device is what it is. Well, you can imagine amplification, for instance, I don't know, maybe it's a phosphorylation of the transcription, basal transcription apparatus that makes it run faster. That's probably what that amplification is. What the AND logic probably means is that if this complex of three proteins is such that if one of them isn't there, it falls apart. Yeah, I think the multiplication is probably enzymatic, and it must affect, it probably binds a cofactor which reaches over and tickles the basal transcription apparatus. That's what I would guess.
So like in that case, where B multiplies A four times.
Right.
So you have these.
You have these three proteins, and probably they bind something which activates some kinase that steps up the activity of the basal apparatus. That's what I would guess. But that's a guess. Yeah?
How much site
does
the DNA bend?
Oh, those, we didn't put them in. That's that DNA bending looping protein that I pointed to before that has the little yellow circles. So we just didn't put that in. It's not really a part of the logic. It's a general architectural facilitator. Okay. Yeah, absolutely. That's how we did this. We ended up predicting and checking exactly the shape of these curves. And yes, that's what that is. A list of, so many of these weren't done until after we had the idea, and then we just checked and checked everything. So anyway, this is probably the best known developmental cis regulatory system out there. And so what's its philosophical implication? My view is there's nothing unusual about this gene, as I said. There's thousands of genes that are regulated during development. You have to think of the genome, in my opinion, as a long string of information processing devices. And every one of them takes multiple inputs that these are multicellular animals that enable, just like this thing, enable this gene to respond to conditions in every cell, everywhere, over all time in the embryo. So that's what this is. And every gene has to do that. So you want to think about evolution, that's what evolution has created. Yes. That's right. It's four or five. I don't think. Exactly right. Yeah. Yeah. Embryos? Yes, those are averages of 100 embryos per point. So I didn't show you the standard deviations, but. Different fluctuations, you say?
Did you analyze the fluctuations?
We just did we checked, of course, the variance or standard deviations around these things. And I would say that the, except for the very early part of the system, it's very robust, and the variance is pretty constant across the whole thing. Early on, at the beginning of the curves, it's harder to control, and that's because the activity is low, and we can't make good measurements. We can't make measurements where the signal-to-noise ratio is high enough to give us reliable numbers for the early part. But so this is my take-home lesson for this. And what I want to talk about now is an intergene network. Whoops, that's upside down. It's OK. So the thing I want to talk about is how does the endoderm and mesoderm get specified. So what you see, there's a blue ring of cells that are going to become the gut. And inside of them are cells that form these mesodermal cell types that appear in the interior of the embryo. Okay? So how does that happen? Now, this is a much bigger question than how one gene gets regulated. There's probably at least 200 or 300 different genes that are involved in that process. How are they linked? And I want to just pause for a minute and make the point that everything that you can see happening in development is caused by a network of interacting genes. And the simplest kind of network is a network that just controls a differentiated state of a cell, for instance, muscle cell. So a muscle cell expresses 50 different muscle proteins, 10 contractile proteins, all kinds of other proteins, and they're under control of about 5 different transcriptional regulators. So that's a simple kind of a network. There's no feedback in this network, but anything that has to do with a big piece of development is mediated by genes controlling encoding transcription factors, and they're hooked up together. So one regulatory gene affects the activity of another one, affects the activity of another one, listens to signals from next door cells, and there are feedbacks in every other kind of relation in those networks. And the biggest problem that we have in understanding genomics, now that we have the genome sequences, is how to read the architecture of those networks out of a DNA sequence, and no one knows how to do that. And why don't we know how to do it? Because not one network has ever been solved at the DNA level yet. So that's a tough job to knock your head against, which is something that we're engaged in trying to do in this felicitous system right now. But no one's solved the network. We'd like to be able to look at a DNA sequence and say, well, here is a cluster of target sites. That's a regulatory module that must connect to this and this and this. And you'd like to be able to look at the sequence and draw the network organization. We can't do it. That's one cis regulatory element. No. No. You're absolutely correct. And you can't do any stupid thing like measure with microchips and see correlation groups. And you're hopeless with that. You have to do some experiments. Now, one day we'll know enough about when target site for X and Y are together, oh, that's a multiplication device. But we don't know that yet. Someday we'll know that when we see the red factor and the blue factor binding there, and we can recognize the target sites, we'll say that's a multiplication device because we're familiar with it. Maybe we'll know that.
Because, as you said, the protein.
That's what I mean. When protein X and protein Y bind those particular proteins and they work together, then we'll be able to recognize that at the DNA level, but we can't do that now.
We had a lecture here last week about such a network in Flagella or Ebola.
Yes.
It involves something like 20-some genes, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
They are interlinked in one transcription structure from other. So that looks like being close to being solved.
Yes. It's a incredibly simple situation compared to any of these situations because of the regulatory control is simple-minded compared to these things. I mean, there are a lot of genes that I don't know how many genes they're required to make a flagellum, maybe 100 of different proteins, but they have to be transcribed in several batches, but they're not many batches. And so it's a simple regulatory problem compared to how you get these cells to decide to be this and not that, and these cells to decide to be this and not that. And also, I have to tell you, bacteria and yeast are models for themselves and not for animal cells. And
that depends on who you listen
to. I'm sorry, I'm telling you the way nature is, not who you listen. There is nothing that anyone has ever seen in a yeast that looks like that. That has, I mean, a yeast regulatory system may have one or two target sites, period. And that's just fact. And everyone knows that if you look at animal cis regulatory elements, they're all the same. They're equally complex. And I'll show you that.
So before going after the logical control, how well do you define even the networks, just with what transfactors hook up with what cis sites based on information in the DNA sequence?
How well can one do it now?
Yeah.
Not well. The target site, the databases for target sites are very poor. And so you can't look at a sequence and say this is what the X transcription factor binds here. And partly it's because the sites are degenerate that some factors like. So, for instance, a given site will bind a family of sequences which differ so much that computationally people have a hard time recognizing what's particular about that site, because if they just say, well, this position, and these other two positions always have to be there, that allows 1 million sites in the genome, and so you just can't get there from here for many factors. There are a few that you can always recognize, but many of them, I would say majority of the target sites are not recognizable at present.
Such a vast system of regulation is perhaps very fragile. You just kick out one element and the organism is dead. That implies that there should be a system of robustness.
You are correct, and there is. I don't think that the animal would be dead if it had a little less endo-16 in its digestive tract. I'm sure all of us vary in that respect. In our own digestive tracts, for example. Some of us are better at this than at that. But for the networks that would kill the animal if they didn't work, like not making a mesoderm, are very robust. Now, why are they robust? They're robust because they're all parallel wired. If you knock something out, it'll still run, maybe not as well, and they're feedback. So if something goes, and people who do knockouts see this all the time. You knock a gene out, and I didn't see any phenotype. Why is that? I didn't see any effect. And later they find out that when they knocked out this gene, two other genes got expressed at a higher level. There's a lot of robustness built into these systems, and you're exactly right.
But I would expect the elements of robustness present in every regulatory scheme by then, already at the elementary level.
I think you're right. I mean, there are elements of robustness here, of course. The main things you can do, if you knock out this site, it's dead. It can't do anything. But there are few sites like that, and you can, and most of the outputs you get are variants that might, I don't know how much it needs this protein, but under some circumstance at least it might work. parallel wiring is part of it. Nothing's linear, and that's and. Say again. Yes.
So you modify your equation.
Yes. You get a different output. Well, it depends on what you want. I mean, what's your object? My object is to try to obtain, for once, a complete description of the relation between the nucleotide sequence and the regulatory function. So that I need to know everything I can to obtain that object. If I want to know what's needed to make this animal have some endo-16 protein, two-thirds of those conditions will give it some endo-16 protein, or three-quarters of them. I may not have to know these details. Depends on your object. For a network analysis between genes, you don't have to know these kinds of details so much. You have to know the key termini that link one gene to another. So we have to think about what, if you're going to study a gene network, you've got to figure out what you're going to study. So the key parts that are listed here are the regulatory control elements and the linkages between the elements that connect all these different kinds of genes together. So the three classes of genes indicated, the genes that actually do the work, which is make the proteins that do the work, which are the proteins that enable the cells to crawl or digest or whatever they have to do. And then there are the regulatory genes that control those genes. And then there are the genes that provide this system with its ability to respond to what different cells are doing, which is intercellular signal systems, which are very important because every gene in every cell has to be aware of what the other cells are doing. And that's how, in fact, the genes are often told where they are and what time it is in the life cycle. So all signal systems work, if they're real, they affect anything by affecting transcription factors. So they ultimately, signal systems affect gene control systems. Otherwise, they're pointless. So, in the case of this network, there was a lot of biology that had been done that indicated, in a crude sense, the inputs and outputs into the system that enables cells to find out whether they're mesoderm or endoderm or something else. So I'm not going to take you guys through that biology. I just want to show you what the shape of the system looks like. So just look at the bottom part of this diagram. And this is what you might call a pre-network analysis that shows what you have to think of functionally when you get down to the point of thinking about what the gene control apparatus is doing. So what happens first is that a plate of cells get defined as the ancestors of both the endoderm and the mesoderm. And early in development, that happens as a result of a dual input. There's a signal, intercellular signal, from the cells that you saw in my diagram as the red cells that ultimately produce the skeleton. And that's a signal passed between cells. And there's also something else that happens, which is the transport into the nucleus at the south pole of the egg of some transcription control molecules. That's this system. And if you look for those molecules with an immunological stain, looking from the bottom of the egg, every cell specifically that has those molecules in the nucleus, which is white there, participates in endomesoderm specification, and no other cell does. So, and both of those functions, if they're interrupted, prevent any endomesoderm specification. So, and if you prevent it, the effect is not subtle. You end up with a ball of cell wall and no gut in the middle. So, I mean, it's a dramatic effect. So, what happens next is that there's another signal from these micrometers at the South Pole, and the cells right in the middle of the vegetal discs that are touching them get turned on to be mesoderm by that signal, and they turn off the endoderm pathway. And so you get an inner disc of mesoderm and an outer ring of endoderm. And that outer ring of endoderm is just what you saw before endo-16 was a good marker of it. There are two auto-amplification loops, one that runs in the original vegetal plate, one that runs in the mesoderm. And they operate by the cells in those fields sending signals to one another, which then stimulate the sending of the same signal from one cell to another. It happens inside the field. And so if you cut either of these loops, you ruin the respective function. It doesn't happen. Okay, so we can that's just an outline of what goes on. So now what our job is to think about this in terms of gene regulatory systems. How can you cut it?
Yeah, how is it cut from going to other cells? So there's this self-amplification.
Yeah, so once it becomes an endomesoderm cell, it transcribes a gene that encodes a signal that goes to another endomesoderm cell, which receives the signal and transcribes more of that same gene. And when it receives that signal, it also turns on endomesoderm genes. So it's a very neat little device. Exactly the same thing happens in the mesoderm itself, different signal. So that's a robustness for you, for example. Once it gets turned on, it amplifies its state. That's kind of neat. At least that's my interpretation of what the you know, you have to take a step to look at the observations you read in the literature from somebody injecting this or that to abstract it. So I'm pretty sure that's right. Okay, so now I don't want to get you all tired, and so I'm not going to take you through the gory details, but I want to show you the approach that we can take here. So we have to make a model to start, as usual. Now, what you're looking at here is a priori model, again, a kind of a logic model, which consists of a series of imaginary cis regulatory elements with different inputs into them and which carry out different logic functions that we can deduce from what you just saw and the ancillary biological observations. So this, for example, is that amplification, self-amplification loop of the endomesoderm, and this is the self-amplification loop in the mesoderm itself. And what we're looking at here is a several-stage process. This is an endomesoderm regulatory gene, but actually it will be a set of genes. And after it becomes activated, downstream of it will be some other genes that will run in the endomesoderm. And also downstream of it will be endoderm-only and mesoderm-only regulatory genes, and a set of genes that run only in the mesoderm that make the contractile proteins or whatever, and a set of genes that run only in the endoderm. And what's up on top is that signaling apparatus. So it's just a formalism that enables us to take the step of thinking about what's in the DNA that we need to think about in order to accommodate all the observations that lead to that. That's all. So it's a start. So what we have done is to do the following. And in collaboration with the DOE Joint Genome Institute, which is one of the country's gigantic sequencing engines, we have isolated about 100 genes that are involved in this system. And we've isolated these genes by cutting these loops and using a method of differential recovery of genes so that we get genes that are expressed when you don't cut the loop and not expressed when you do cut the loop. And we can see those genes and isolate them. And we've isolated big, huge pieces of genomic DNA, which are 100 to 150,000 base pairs in length, which have the genes somewhere in the middle of them. JGI people have sequenced them for us, and by using a combination of statistical computational methods, sequence comparison, cis regulatory analysis of the kind that I've been talking about, and another kind of experiment where you knock the gene out and look and see which of the other genes are affected by that, we're beginning to put this network together. So that's the project, and I'll be glad to describe a few aspects of what I just said if you want me to. For right now, the take-home lesson is this is what has to be done if we're ever going to understand how developmental regulation is really programmed at the beyond the single gene level.
Do you have a philosophical basis for why the cell would have something as complicated as what you show looks to me, where I have no...
This is a whole embryo, not a cell.
...as unnecessarily complicated. It may be necessary for all of your observations.
You mean if you were designing it, why would you have to do it that way? Yeah, I don't think it's unnecessarily complicated at all, because the of course that's a wonderful question that we could spend a long time on, but the short answer is that this isn't the only gene in the world, and these aren't the only genes that the embryo has to play with. It has a small number of relatively small number of transcription factors compared to genes that it uses, and so it has to use a combinatorial apparatus in order to run all the things the right way at the right time. Most of the encoding is in the cis regulatory elements, and a lot of it is to tell the genes when to be silent. So for example, why does it have to do this? Well, because once the gene becomes a mesoderm, it doesn't want to express the endoderm genes. But you can't just turn them all off by one simple thing, because they're all turned on by a variety of different things. And so there are a variety of, and also you have to consider, which I'm sure you consider more than anything, evolution. And these systems were built from simpler systems, and a system can't evolve by going back to ground level zero. It has to build on what there was before. So. Those are some of the reasons why this is true. Now, the more appropriate question, or less teleological question, is do you need a system of this complexity to describe the observations? That's for sure. What?
Sometimes you hear that. When you put a thing imaging by having a hierarchy, Hochstein is one calling.
Yeah, these are not hierarchical systems. That's a very interesting point. They're parallel systems, and they have a lot of sideways linkages, which you don't even see. Well, you see that they're probably there by logic, and they're going to be there for sure. So here are about 30 genes that are put on this network in different places by experiment. So that's really the answer to do we need this complexity of organization to accommodate what's actually there. The fact is that when you look at genes and see where they're expressed under what conditions, yes, you need these different locations. So what I want to do is just show you the kinds of tools that we have.
Concept example to this complexity basis. For example, if you want to, if someone asks you to say design a circuit that would do what say the E. coli flagella system does, say the checkpoint.
Right.
I would guess an average human designer would make a very complicated circuit, but nature has a very ingenious way of doing that sort of thing.
Part of the problem is what I was what I was telling Walter is these things have evolved, and every animal you look at is a little bit different, and so they have to build linkages on top of what's there, because they have to take something that works and is selectively useful and build on top of it. So they're not always orderly systems. There's a lot of redundancy in these systems. That's probably contributes to their robustness. I think that we can't possibly look at these systems in isolation from either their history or their genetic context and discuss that question.
From the point of view of designing a system, let's say if I inherit somebody's software code to add some new function, if that code is already a mess, it's just tremendous to add something that does not screw something up, and then
the code is a mess.
Right.
The code is a mess, but it's
something in the code itself that allows you to add.
Yes. There's a lot of things that what you would call, I would call evolvability.
Yes.
A lot of things. Now, one of the things is what we were discussing before. It doesn't matter where these regulatory elements are. In some of these huge pieces of DNA that we've sequenced, the regulatory elements are far away from the genes. Some of them are in the introns. It doesn't matter where the hell they are. If you look in different animals, they're in different places. So that's one aspect of it. Secondly, the same phenomenon that makes it possible to do the experiments I was talking about before, which is inject a piece of DNA that goes in anywhere and works, means that the binding affinities, if you will, or the binding constants for interaction between the diffusible factors and a piece of DNA, and once a complex is formed between that and the basal transcription apparatus, are so high that they will find their targets no matter what. And so those things contribute to evolvability. Neither of them's true in bacteria, by the way.
But I could argue that that's also bad, because if it really doesn't depend on where, I put this binding site.
Well, it has to be somewhere.
If it could activate this or that.
No, it has to be. I should have been more careful in my statement. Where with respect to the start point of the gene, but it can't be on the other side of the next gene, except in a few special systems. And where those systems do exist, like the Hox complex, there are elaborate controls and insulators, as I was saying, that isolate different pieces of the apparatus. Right. Correct. That's interesting. Yeah.
And you're saying, is that a consequence of past events, or is there something that's done intentionally?
Well, intentionally, you don't mean intentionally, but something that has a function, you mean. So the selective part of this system are the genes at the end of the pathway. The genes that provide the mesoderm cells with their actual properties. their differentiated properties. Can they crawl around? Can they, do they have contractile proteins, et cetera, et cetera? And the same for the genes in the endoderm, of which there are not many shown, there's a lot more. And the part of the system that controls those are all these regulatory genes that are upstream of them in these different domains. And these are genes that are involved in getting to the point where there is an endoderm and a mesoderm, the endomesodermal initial specification. So this is the signal that controls that initial loop that I showed you before. That's that gene. So this is what's selected. Now, because of, so with respect to robustness, because it's desirable selectively not to lose those activities, but it's important to put them in just the right cells and control their rate, these are all wired in parallel, and none of these genes is run by one regulator, which is usually the case, for example, in yeast and bacteria, genes run by a single regulator. They all require sets of regulators, which then often have a positive feedback loops amongst them to make sure that this thing runs. So if you knock one down a little bit, then the other one runs more. And so it's full of devices of this kind because of the selective pressure on the end product.
So, the sort of technical version of the software development doesn't happen. Has a lot of things
rush
holding on the
expression
level of, you know,
earlier
genes or something.
I mean, of course, that's right. So far, we haven't been able to focus on this. You need genomic sequence to do this. Drosophila genomic sequence is there. It would be nice if my Drosophila colleagues were to start working in these networks. But actually, it's such a bear of a problem, you have to be a nut to take your laboratory and go at it. And it's a problem that, like many interdisciplinary problems, resists the way our science is set up. I mean, in order to do this job, I have a collaboration with a mathematical computer science department at another university. I have a collaboration with a big sequencing genomics operation that the DOE runs. We do everything from cytology to, you know, DNA protein physical chemistry. And I happen to have a pretty good sized lab, so I can take this on. But it's a interdisciplinary kind of problem, and so networks just haven't been approached yet. But this is the way it works, and we know enough already to know that this is the way it works, and there are little pieces of networks that exist. I just wrote a book, and you can find some examples in there. That yeah. I always say that unless you're a human or a mouse, it's about 95 to 99% transcriptional regulation. We mammals have used alternative splicing a lot more than other animals do. We've done everything we can to get more different proteins out of the same number of genes. The average number of different proteins that humans produce is about 3 per gene, which is a lot of different proteins because of alternative splicing, and that's not really translation level control, but it's post-transcriptional control. So our proteins have more domains in them than, say, Drosophila or worm proteins. They have more, so we've done more to get various different proteins produced. Of course, everything is ultimately genetically controlled. We all know that. We also have taken given genes and replicated them and then put different cis regulatory elements in front of replicas of almost of genes encoding almost the same protein. And for instance, there's something like 23 genes that encode TGF-beta signaling factors, which is one of the intracellular signals that in our genomes, and Drosophila has 3, if I recall correctly. And sea urchins probably have about 6. 23 is a big number. Everyone is expressed differently at a different time, in a different place, because of different cis regulatory apparatus. So we mammals have gone another step to get more complexity out of the apparatus to start with. Yes.
Average,
yeah. It's amazing. From the human genome sequence. They're comparing cDNAs to genome. I think it's about the same. Did you ever open it up? But other than to eat the gonads, I mean. Yeah, it has an intestinal tract just like we do. It has a very complicated gonads, ovaries with many little lobules. It has a terrific immune system. It has a mesodermal lining just like we do around its gut and inside its body wall. It has a very complicated mouth with teeth, and it also has it has thousands of these little tube feet that extend off the top of it, off the outside, which it moves around, which are innervated by nerves. It's a pretty complicated animal.
How big is the brain?
It doesn't have a brain.
How big is the
brain? In terms of the number of cells, I don't think it's known. It's not more complicated, I'm sorry. I think that we have a big problem in biology, which is making subjective judgments like that one. And the way that we can get away from being subjective is if we saw the architecture of the networks that are required to build all the body parts and compare them, use an objective measure of complexity, like the number of linkages or something like that, I'll give you dimes to dollars. Drosophila is no more complicated than sea urchins. I don't think any bilateria are more complicated than any others, except for a few that are you might consider degenerate. That's true. I'm not defending it. I'm just.
I'm joking. But rather than doing that, it would be really interesting to find out. How would the genome be actually much smaller? Gene number wise, about half the number. Size of the genome, about 6 the number.
Mm-hmm.
So something that does so much. And whether sea urchin does things in a very ingenious way, but there is something new added to Drosophila that allows it to be more effective.
Well, the world, the animal world is very big. Let me just skip to something here. Well, let's do this. First of all, here are some Drosophila cis regulatory elements that are equivalent to endo-16. And they're pretty similar to the one I was talking to you about in terms of number of inputs per cis regulatory element. Here are some from mammals. There's endo-16 and another sea urchin one on top. You don't have to know what the blobs are, what they mean. The red ones are repressors. The different shapes mean different inputs to the. These are Drosophila developmental genes. They work exactly the same as the sea urchin ones do. So on this level, there's no difference. Okay? Now, if you look at the phylogenetic tree of animals, here are the chordates. Here are the echinoderms, of which the sea urchin is one. These are another kind of invertebrate, hemichordates. These, what? Ribosomal sequences mainly, but also Hox gene sequences confirm this rather impressively. And there's other evidence as well. The other evidence isn't as good as far as I'm concerned. But this is a very heavily studied area at this point. So, here's Drosophila up here. Here are nematodes. Here are all the clams and mollusks and lots of other kinds of animals. They're all complicated. They all have mesodermal sheets in their body. They all have different, they all have sensory systems. They all have immune systems. They all have digestive systems. They all have a bilateral organization. They all have central nervous systems. They all have the basic suite of anatomical characters that define the bilaterians. They all have Hox complexes that are the same, except the nematode one is degenerate. It's been blown to bits. It isn't used for as much as it is in other animals. And essentially, since the chordates are at least as complicated as anything else, Drosophila is a pretty complicated animal, but so are a lot of these other guys that are pretty complicated animals. And in some respects, you know, Drosophila is pretty simple compared even to other insects. It lives a very short time. It has probably doesn't have nearly as much need for an immune system, for instance, as long-lived animals do, like sea urchins, for instance. It has an immune system, but doesn't have very much of one. And they're all complicated. You can see from the phylogenetic tree that the ability to organize gene networks for development has got to be a shared feature of the ancestor, the common ancestor of all the bilaterally organized animals. And in fact, one of the things that we've learned is that not only do all these guys have the same suite of transcription factor genes, the same signal transduction systems, the same toolkit, but they even use pieces of that toolkit the same way. For instance, they use all the same genes to make their guts. They use similar genes to make their heads. They use similar genes to make their hearts, et cetera, et cetera. So there's no argument, in my humble opinion, for saying that any of these guys know secrets that the other ones don't know with respect to regulatory complexity.
What are the differences between two closely related pieces on the tree?
Like, you mean like these guys?
At the level of like within a module, one has a three binding site for this M, another has five?
I don't think so. I think the difference is network architecture. That means where the linkages are.
Still the same module.
Yes. I think at the level of the, I mean, I think it's a fact of life that at the level of the individual cis regulatory element, there's equivalent complexity across the bilateria. And no one knows, the sister group of us are the jellyfish and corals. They're very different. It's a very ancient divergence that may go back a billion years. It's not clear how old that divergence is. It may be less, but it's very distant, and they may even have have cis regulatory elements of similar complexity, but no one's ever done an experiment to find out. Deuterostomes, they're the red guys. They were originally noticed in 1909 by a comparative anatomist who had a very good ability to abstract essences of embryological processes. And they originally defined as the animals who form their endomesoderm in a certain way, differently from all the other guys. And that way is results in the place where the invagination of the embryo forms becoming the anus. And in these guys, it becomes the mouth.
So the red guys include all of us.
Yes, yes.
And the only invertebrates that are included in red are the sea urchins and what are the
hemichordates? No, that's not true. There are invertebrate chordates. For instance, somebody at this university works on an interesting invertebrate chordate, your colleague called Smith, who, and those are very, those animals, no, that's another invertebrate chordate, that's also an invertebrate chordate, but the ascidians are don't look very much like chordates except for a few hours of their life cycle. The embryo gives rise to a larva that has a dorsal nerve cord, a head, some eye spots, and
what,
that's a chordate
what's
too.
What's really fascinating is that to a child that goes to a zoo, we look absolutely different.
Yeah, I know.
Than the echinoderma and all the others.
Yes.
And in fact, what you say is that they are very, very similar to us.
This is the most robust, from a molecular phylogeny point of view, this is the most robust clade on here, practically.
Maybe we'll get Eric to complete his main.
That's all right, this is fascinating too.
We finished the talk about 15 minutes ago, and this was the
We're skipping lots of slides.
To me, it's all one subject, so I think development and evolution are two sides of the coin. One is changes in developmental regulatory networks in time, and the other is its operation and within the life cycle. So I'm happy to discuss this also. I'll go back to those things. So this is why I started with that picture of the fish and the sea urchin, because you want to know what's the difference. Why? What is it that causes what looks so different to the child? Well, it's what I'm talking about here. Go back. You want to hear more mechanism? Me too. Okay. All right. So what I want to show you some of the tools we have to unravel this. So how in the hell do you ever organize these genes? So one thing we can do is knock out the gene expression cheaply and easily by one of two ways. We can inject into the egg a kind of antisense oligonucleotide that binds the message and prevents it from being translated into protein. And then you can take all the other genes, once you know who they are, and ask what's the effect. So, for instance, here's a case where one of these genes was knocked out, and the result is that the activity of its own self drops, so we know that this gene regulates itself. The activity of this gene, which is expressed in an adjacent territory, goes up, so we know that that transcription factor represses this gene. The activity of this one goes down, so we know that it activates that gene, and so forth. So we can get, and we can also see activities that are affected via intercellular signaling, because this gene also runs some signal which affects genes in a different adjacent territory. So this is a very powerful logic tool for seeing where in the DNA sequence to look for transcription factor target sites, as you can see.
It's not
RNA interference, but it's equivalent. It's equivalent. It's easier to use than RNA interference. It's just a little chemical. It's a substitute oligonucleotide. So some genes run a great number of other genes. This is one of those that those are all targets of one transcription factor, and that's one of these guys down towards the end of the line. That's this gene, and all of those genes are of this sort and this sort. And no, you prevent. There are several ways, but the way we use it, I was just talking about, was you prevent the protein from being made. So here's the message, and this molecule binds to the message, and the ribosome tries to run along and read the message and stops. So no protein. So then, because the real time turnover of these factors is half-life of half an hour or 2 hours, it goes away. Gene's still there.
The messenger may be around, but the protein will not be.
That's right, no protein.
If you measure the concentration of messenger RNA.
In this case, the messenger RNA stays the same. Now, there are other things you can do that make the message go away, but this is one that just, this is the best way for this system. So, that's very useful. So, now we can get logic relations. We also can probably use features of these cis-regulatory elements to predict where they are in unknown DNA sequence. For example, if you consider how they're designed, they're usually multiple target sites for given transcription factors, often like the common factors in NL16. So we can use features like that and look for improbable occurrence of that sort of thing. And we can also look at interspecies comparisons. And I'll just show you one more piece of data. Whoops, maybe I didn't bring it. I guess I didn't bring it. What we can do is take another species of DNA, and because the rate of change of DNA is high, roughly speaking, you could say 1% per million years. That's an average rate of change. Walter can give you much better numbers on that, but for animal DNA, just to give you an idea. And what that means is that the different genera, for example, in sea urchins, have been apart since their common ancestor for 20, 50, 100 million years. And so that means that anything that isn't being used is going to change. And in the intergenic DNA sequence, it turns out to be extremely informative for finding not only genes but regulatory elements. To look in the intergenic sequence around a given gene, which is you find in both species, and look and see where is the sequence conserved. And it's these little patches of conservation, and they turn out to be an excellent guide as to where the cis-regulatory elements are. So anyway, I think I'll stop here and we can just have a more open discussion. I wanted to give you an idea of the tools that we have for that can be applied to the network problem, because it's a soluble problem. It just has to be done. And they are looking for cis-regulatory elements by sequence comparison or statistical methods, testing them as you saw us do with the Endo16 system, using these logic relation knockout experiments to see what genes upstream of what genes are independent, using the biology to start with a logic model so we know that we don't put something downstream on top of something upstream, just for starters, and cutting the network by cutting these loops so that we can then use a differential comparison method to get genes that are expressed when you don't cut it, when you do cut it. And that gives us the players that are involved in these boxes. And we have very good methods for doing that. And I think all those things put together will provide us with a, it's not done yet, so I have to say I think, provide us with a way of reading the DNA sequence and say, here is the architecture of the regulatory system that makes this endomesoderm specification work. And that's my view, what has to be done to understand the genome in general. Yeah. No kidding. That's not a suggestion, that's a fact.
Yeah, okay. But why, is that once you've got one regulator, getting a second regulator doesn't seem like a hard task. Why can't the bacteria not found a way of doing this if they
did, they became
two urchins. The bacteria are still bacteria.
The reason is that it's what I started out saying right in the beginning. What really costs the regulatory energy, if you will, or the complexity is spatial control of gene expression. And bacteria don't have that problem. They don't have that problem. And they don't have any different cell types. They don't run differentiation gene batteries. They do. They run a few gene batteries, like flagellar gene batteries. They make spores. It's nothing compared to what all of the cell types that we have do. And cell types doesn't make an animal. It's the project of installing stepwise the different spatial domains of gene expression that costs the regulatory energy. For instance, just take a muscle cell. You might say, well, that's just like a flagella. It makes muscle protein instead of flagella. But when you actually look at how muscle cell types are, or muscle proteins are regulated, muscle cell types, there are fast muscles, there are slow muscles, there are twitch muscles, and they're all loaded into the same piece of muscle. And every one of those is a different gene battery. Every one of those cell types, which you may use the same myosin, is a different cis regulatory module that gets called in when that cell type is specified. So there may be 10 regulatory modules on muscle actin because there are 10 cell types it's used in. Bacteria don't have these problems. That's a spatial and developmental problem. And bacterial systems are designed entirely differently so that they're much more rigid, and you can't move a target site that a transcription factor binds at on the one face of the DNA. You turn it around by half a turn of DNA, it won't work. These systems are entirely impervious to that sort of stuff. Don't know. Well, yeast are yeast. There you go. Yeast is pretty good, and yeast cell types, yeast regulation is much more like bacteria than like this. Much more. See, what those guys do, basically, is physiology. They respond to how salty it is, how hot it is, how sweet it is, and how cold it is, and how wet it is, and what food sources are there, and what sugars are there. That's what they do. And all of their stuff is physiological. We have isolated all the bilateria, have isolated their whole systems from the outside world to a tremendous extent. They all live inside body walls, which have very potent homeostatic protection mechanisms of different kinds, and they're with sensory neuronal systems. All the bilateria have peripheral nervous system of equivalent complexity. And they don't even bother with doing those things that bacteria do. That's why we need bacteria's commensals for some of these physiological chemical responses. So we're oriented toward development. So you knock a gene out, there's one of these transcription factors, instead of getting a gut or an embryo, you get a ball of cells. That's just one of them. And you could do the same thing with about 20 of the genes on that network. They're all necessary, yeah. Yeah. In the early stages of it. Get to the end of it, it doesn't collapse. But you can see a pretty dramatic effect there. That's one of these knockouts.
And the complexity of organism and regulatory system goes with complexity of environment.
I think my answer, although it sounds completely right, because we see around us the stages of every stage in evolution. And those that are simple, you don't ask why they are simple and not complex. They are simple because they are the ones that have not evolved further and stayed with the genome same as it was probably 2 billion years ago. And others became more complicated and became sea urchins or human beings. So asking why sea urchins don't have eyes or brain is...
They do have a big ganglia around their around their oral apparatus, by the way.
But, they stay like that in other animals.
Their ancestors, by the way, were probably bilaterally organized and probably did have brains. They've lost them.
They actually are...
backwards?
I think so. A lot of animals are like that. I think nematodes are that way too, and I think ascidians are that way too, but it's my view. But what? I think it's not uncommon that small, there's some niches for small, rapidly developing animals that have stripped down their apparatus, which scientists happen to like. And so an uncommon number of our models are probably degenerate in terms of... I think that the invention of what I've told you today occurred before the Cambrian explosion, but was necessary for it. That's my opinion.
So other species that look like what was before the explosion that live today show the same thing?
There's a very, very poor and extremely contentious fossil record from before the so-called explosion. So the way that you can use the word explosion and know you're right, whatever else happened, is it's an explosion of fossil evidence. Now, the relation between that, you have to think about, as with every other kind of evidence, what it means. There's no question that there's fossils appear, and I was, as a matter of fact, 2 weeks ago in southwest China looking at microscopically scaled fossils from about 50 million years before the Cambrian. There's a lot of things no one's looked at that are very interesting. It's premature to really say that I think there certainly were these guys present, and that's for sure. And there seemed to be some, at least some early life stages of something that looks on the Bioterian line, and maybe some later life stages.
Are there examples of multicellular organisms that are on the order of 10 to 100 cells?
You mean adult?
Adult, or any stage.
Well, these larvae, like the completed sea urchin embryo, is about 10 times more than that. 10 cells, I don't know of any. Animals, but
so there's a gap between saying one.
Yeah, that's correct. Well, you know, I would disagree with one thing that you said. We do not see around us vestiges of all stages of evolution. We see the crown groups that have survived of all branches of many, of not all, but some branches of evolution. But whatever was this guy, we don't see the vestiges of that around. It was long ago eaten by its descendants, and I think the same must go for... There are some very strange little metazoans, trichoplacts and this and that, that have 100 cells and a few different cell types that nobody knows where to classify or what they are, and you could say slime molds or things like that if you wanted to. But very, not very prominent, let's put it that way. Yes. I think the simplest animals, of which there are many, many examples from all across this tree, not the blue guys, but all these guys, many examples are larvae of annelid worms or sea urchins and hemichordates, and many, many, many of these groups produce these things that have about 1,000 cells that can feed, are single cell thick, have 10 or 12 cell types, and that's the next stage that we still can see, but they're not adults.
So the larvae of the sea urchin that you showed us are really small.
Yeah. It's 170 microns or something, 2,000, 1,000 cells.
The same number of cells in nematodes.
Yes. That's right. That's exactly correct. A nematode's pretty simple too. It's not nearly this simple. It's an adult body plan. And since there are many other great big nematodes out there, which people know very little about, except to know that the characteristics of C. elegans are not represented in terms of their developmental process in these other nematodes, probably C. elegans is one of these stripped down guys that's been streamlined for a 3-day life cycle in between sand grains, but...
So, in terms of the sea urchin, all this stuff you know or think you know about the Grell Neural Network published anywhere, on the web anywhere?
I think the best thing I could refer you to on the Endo 16 is all published.
Right.
The rest of it, I would recommend you to you a book that I just wrote. It just came out 2 months ago. It's pretty up to date. It's called Genomic Regulatory Systems, and it was published by Academic Press. And it has reviews of levels of complexity of this kind throughout the bioelectronic world, the sort of thing that goes on in these embryos and also in adult body part formation. And that's the best summary I could. I mean, if there was something else, I wouldn't have bothered going to the work of writing it.
I'm also curious.
And there's a lot of references in that.
Okay. So when you put in,
it's about all kinds of animals, by the way, not just sea urchins. Yeah.
So you look at how the expression levels of other genes change. Is this only the genes you know about?
Yes.
So what fraction of the genes is that?
Of the genes in the network?
In the sea urchin, right? Because you don't have the whole sea urchin sequence.
No, we don't.
So
I think there, though, we have some from the sequence there is. It's about 7% of a sequence or something. And from the sequence that there is, a gene estimate is about 22,000 genes or so. There are about 8,500 genes used in the embryo as a whole. This network right now has about 100 genes in play in it. There's probably at least 200 genes that can be recovered by these perturbations. And this is not taking, this is taking it up during the period the endomesoderm is forming and doesn't go to the end of, so it may express other genes to enable the cells to crawl faster or produce more gunk or something later. I don't know.
So there may be intervening pieces in some new surface that we don't know.
Yes. Until we know, we don't know. But
right.
I think we're most thorough earliest because we focused mostly in the first 20 hours of development. I think we probably have a pretty good idea of the interrelations there in the period when the blue and the purple concentric system is being set up. But my main point is really that kind of process which underlies all development, complex and simple, is really expensive in regulatory apparatus. And that's what these guys have learned how to do, that kind of a thing.
Back to the egg, you have these concentric patterns and so forth, but ultimately it has to come from the mother cell.
Yeah.
So the spatial organization of, so if you look at a single egg, the spatial organization, is it asymmetric or?
Yes, it's asymmetric. It's got a north pole, south pole polarity. And so the endomesoderm always comes from the south pole, so do the skeletogenic cells. And the cytoarchitectural, I don't really know, but the cytoarchitecture of the egg, it's somehow built into that because if you ruin that with drugs that decompose microfilaments, you ruin this asymmetry. So there's a whole set of genes. So what happens is that there are certain transcription factors that are present in the top part of the egg and not in the bottom. It begins a very crude pattern, and then it gets refined as soon as the cell's own genome start working.
It probably happens during
oogenesis, and what probably happens is that the side of the egg that's against the basement membrane has a different polarity stamped on its own cell membrane than the side of the egg that sticks into the interior of the ovary. There are eggs like that. This one. The second axis is indirectly determined by that. But I was talking about the north-south axis. So the east-west axis depends on where the sperm enters.
Is that from
the sperm?
No.
The sperm can
In this case, the sperm can enter everywhere. It's indirect in this animal. So the sperm enters and it swims around in an eccentric, irreproducible pattern. But it comes to lie against the egg nucleus. Its nucleus lies, it comes to lie against the egg nucleus. So the sperm has two little microtubule organizing centers, one on its tail and one on its head, basically. Or one moves around to the other side of the egg nucleus. So the angle formed by those two sets the position of the mitotic spindle. The position of the mitotic spindle sets the position of the first plane of cleavage. And so that is determined by this eccentric pathway the sperm takes indirectly by that way. And once that plane of cleavage happens, then the second plane of cleavage is always orthogonal to the first one, but in the preformed animal vegetal axis. And the third plane of cleavage is always the opposite angle.
But there has to be a certain degree of robustness to the angle of entry. Basically,
if
my brothers or
my
brothers
are
pretty much
alike.
Huh? So it's the same for humans.
I don't really know what happens in humans. But humans don't have nearly as rigid a cleavage pattern as these guys do.
Everything else is elaboration of the structure that's encoded in
the egg. Now, for example, it's mysterious because once the first cleavage plane goes like this, the second one is always orthogonal to it. How that works, nobody knows, but that works, and that can be in any in any angle, which is very interesting. But
is there a way of understanding left right?
Not by those arguments. There's no relation between the cleavage plane and the left and right side in this thing that's a direct relation. So the east-west axis of the egg, of the embryo, is at 45 degrees to the first cleavage plane 90% of the time. That's what it does, exactly. Exactly that. Precisely. Excellent deduction.
It's contradictory. I mean, everybody else has been coming here telling us that we should think of this as a well-mixed thing with protein to cellulose.
Think of what?
A well-mixed...
A cell, you mean?
Yeah.
It's not a soup.
Yeah, but with transition factors...
When I was an undergraduate, right. And I graduated in 1958, I had a question in my honors exam, what's the difference between a cell and a bag of enzymes? That was 1958. So the guys who are telling you this have forgotten a few things that we've known for many decades. And there's a lot of organization in a cell. And everything, many proteins have tags on them that cause them to be associated with this or that piece of the cellular machinery. Like the Golgi apparatus, or this membrane, or go in the nucleus, or go to the membrane, or stick out of the membrane. All proteins are targeted for the right part of the cell. Now, there are, of course, some soluble things. Okay, anyway.
Thank you. Thank you.